Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made Winston Churchill one of the greatest leaders of the 21st century, and how did his famously big and brilliant personality translate to the intimacy of life with loved ones away from the spotlight? Author and lecturer Celia Sands is the granddaughter of Winston Churchill. Continuing a long family tradition of literary ambition, she was first inspired to write about her legendary forebear in the early 90s, when she discovered a cache of letters Churchill had written between the tender ages of 6 and 20. Since then, she has contributed 5 books to the body of Churchill scholarship, the most recent of which is called We Shall Not Fail, The Inspiring Leadership of Winston Churchill. She's in town to speak this evening at 6 to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Celia, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So your grandfather died when you were in your early 20s, and you waited nearly 30 years to start writing about him. Was there a time where you had to sort of come to terms with the idea of writing about him as someone you loved and also someone that the world knew and loved, but maybe in a very different context?
Not really. No, it wasn't a plan. Mm-hmm. It just happened. I dropped out for 5 years to have my 2 last children. And I'd played babies for 5 years in the West Country in England and had an idyllic time. And then suddenly, as they do, my last child went to school. And I dropped out to such a degree that I thought, what am I going to do with myself mm-hmm. now? Because I'd worked before, but suddenly there I was. And I was having tea with a cousin of mine, an elderly cousin, who was my grandfather's nephew. And we were sitting at the table, and he had this battered old tin trunk sitting in the middle of the table. And I couldn't not comment on it because it was looked so extraordinary sitting there. So I said, what's that? He said, let's have a look. And we got down on the floor, and he opened this little trunk, and out came these wonderful letters and diaries and all sorts of things between my grandfather and his mother and his father and his nanny and his brother. And his school reports. So I said, this is absolutely incredible. It's wonderful. He said, yes, and pushed it over. He said, you do it. Hmm. So that was how I started, without any idea at all. He obviously had the idea of it, and he planned it, but I hadn't. Mm-hmm. And then one thing led to another.
Did you find things in there that you knew would surprise people who thought they knew Churchill's entire life?
I certainly did, because no one had really, apart from he himself, he wrote a book about his early life. But my Uncle Randolph was writing the official biography. And I think he knew he wasn't going to live long enough to finish it. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't very interested in the early years. So he jumped quickly onto the politics. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky because then Martin Gilbert, who continued writing the biography, he arranged that the archives should all be closed until he'd finished. And he took about 30 years to finish it. So they were closed. So no one had seen these letters that were kept, all the letters that weren't in the tin trunk that had been kept in the archives. No one had seen them. So therefore, I had a sort of free run at them, which was very exciting. And it was terribly exciting finding a letter with sort of tear-stained letter that he'd sent from school and all sorts of things, which, you know, they were very poignant. And so my first book was entirely paper research. Mm-hmm. And then my next day, after that, I was able to move on to living research, which I have to say I much prefer. But I didn't know that when I was writing my first book, because my first book was, it was so exciting that I was writing a book that was going to be published. And I also had my 2 young children crawling around looking at pictures of their great-grandfather the same age and saying, can we take this to school?
That would have been an excellent show and tell. So you like traveling around and sort of following in his footsteps, literally.
Literally, I do, yes. I did that in South Africa for about 5.5 months in about 2-3 journeys. And then because I traveled with him when I was a teenager, I then wrote a book retracing his footsteps called Chasing Churchill, and that then led into a PBS documentary and into tours I take people chasing Churchill in various parts of the world. So it's, you know, I've just living with my grandfather for the last 20 years, just like I grew up with him for the first 20 years of my life.
He was, the entire time you were growing up, was living at Chartwell, is that correct?
Well, except for, well, there were 5 years of that when, well, I mean, when I was a baby, I don't remember him, mm-hmm. but he was Prime Minister until 1945. Then he was out until 1951. Then he was back prime minister again. So when he was prime minister, he was living between 10 Downing Street and Chequers, the official prime minister's country house. Otherwise, he was moving between Chartwell and their house near Hyde Park.
What sort of houses were they? Were they cozy? Were they grand?
Well, I suppose it depends who's looking at them. You know, I mean, from my point of view, let me put it another way, in the country, I mean, when I go to Blenheim Palace, where my grandfather was born, I think, wow, this is grand. When I go to Chartwell, I feel this is home and quite cozy. When I take my children to Blenheim, they say, my goodness, we're on another planet. And they go to Chartwell, they think it's very grand. So it's all a question of what you've known yourself. But they certainly wasn't. No, there was nothing very formal about my grandparents, and so they didn't believe in a very very formal life. And from the moment we were able to sit in a proper chair and eat with a knife and fork, we were at the dining room table, regardless of who was there. And so it wasn't a case of children being seen and not heard. We were allowed to air our views if we had any.
How political were dinner table conversations?
Mainly, they were mainly political after the coffee had been served and when the women left the table in old-fashioned English style, which no one does anymore. But we'd have the coffee and my grandmother would rise to her feet and what she described as catch the eyes of the ladies. And we would go out of the room and then the men would be left to have brandy and cigars. And so at that point, I think, is when the politics would have been discussed much more.
You've written about being a teenager and bringing dates to your grandparents' house, and it would just be the four of you, and then some poor boy would be left there to drink brandy or talk with your grandfather. That must have been incredibly intimidating for them.
I think it was quite intimidating, yes. And one of them, I remember his face, because I don't think he realized what was going to happen, and I actually hadn't stupidly warned him. Probably he'd have run away if I had. And so we got to the point of my grandmother saying, shall we leave the men to their cigars? And he just went ashen white. So off I went. Anyway, he was fine. I think he'd probably never smoked a cigar and never had a glass of brandy, but he had both and survived. And found my grandfather actually was very, very good with young men. He totally saw the point of them and always liked to sort of encourage them. So it was all fine.
Was he good with children?
Yes, he was. I mean, he was very friendly with children. He liked children around. I mean, he the only children I saw him with were his grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And I think that we were the only people in the world after the war who took him for granted. And so he didn't have, I mean, we weren't hanging on every word or wondering what he was going to say or asking him questions about the war or anything. We were just happy to go and feed the animals or sit on his knee. So I think that from that point of view, we must have been quite relaxing people to be with because everyone else was either absolutely in awe of him or trying to get an opinion out of him or a memory or something.
You were so very small during those years between the two terms as prime minister. Do you remember anything about how the house felt, how things felt at that point?
Well, I mainly remember when he'd become prime minister for the second time. But I remember sort of in a haze, sort of lovely Christmases and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And as you grew older, it sounds like you had a very special relationship, maybe different even than your siblings and your cousins might have had. Can you talk about how you sort of got to know him as a human being as you got older? Rather than as grandfathers are human beings, but you know what I'm saying, as an adult.
Well, it was a gradual process. People often say, you know, when did you realize that he was a great man or very special or something? And the answer to that is gradually. Mm-hmm. Because we weren't told by our parents, oh, you know, Grandpapa did this or he did that or he did the other. We were just, you know, there we were. You had to sense that there was something going on because there were always a lot of people around and there were photographers wherever he went. But as we grew up with it, we just thought that was normal. That was how life was. So it was really observing other people and seeing how people spoke about him and how they behaved when they were with him that made me realize that they regarded him in a different way to other people. But I mean, I was lucky. I happened to be an available grandchild of an appropriate age to travel with him in sort of the last 5 years of his life. And that was pure chance. It wasn't anything else. And I don't think I was any more favourite than any of the others. It was just that they were doing other things. The ones who were older were busy doing older things, as it were. And the ones who were younger were absolutely too young to go. So I was just in a fortunate sort of slot and had a wonderful time. I had some lovely experiences, and it was really very special to have to myself, if only for short periods, the man the whole world thought they owned.
Did he feel the pressure of that, of always needing to be on, if there was anyone else in the room besides the immediate family? Was that delightful for him, or was it stressful?
I think he rather did exactly what he wanted. And so if he wanted to perform, he performed. And if he didn't, he didn't.
Mm-hmm. We hear so often, you know, people love to quote this extraordinary wit. And that can go both ways. It can be very funny and it can be very hurtful. Was that, obviously he was in full control of it. Was it something that he used less around the family than he did around other people?
Well, I think he had a wit, but he wasn't necessarily, you know, making jokes and things.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book about this book that I've read about leadership style. And one of the things you write about is that he was extraordinarily loyal and really protective of those who worked beneath him. Can you talk about some of what you've learned about that?
Well, I think he understood people in a way that perhaps people don't acknowledge. I mean, he'd had a difficult childhood. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that he grew up being the sort of the most successful boy in the school and always succeeding and everything. He had to fight to get to the position where he felt that he was confident of what he was doing. I mean, he was a very precocious child. He was clever, but he didn't get on with his peers. He didn't do well at school because he only didn't work at all at the things he didn't like. And so he wasn't really what you'd call a team player at school, mm-hmm. or perhaps anywhere. And therefore, but he did understand. For instance, I've spoken, and I'm great friends with several of the people who worked with him as his secretaries. And they, I think some of them couldn't take the strain, and they did, but they then disappeared. Mm-hmm. But the ones who stayed the course, they ended up adoring him and really liking him. And that didn't mean that they didn't say that he was impossible at times, but they said that one thing he did have, he always, as he described, never let the sun go down on his wrath. Mm-hmm. And so he always said sorry. If he'd been difficult, he always said sorry. Maybe not in so many words, but he would communicate with anyone who he'd may have been a bit rough with that he was apologetic.
So that he would sort of let them know that all was forgiven and
start
over again tomorrow. My guest this hour is Celia Sands, author and lecturer and granddaughter of Winston Churchill. Among her books is We Shall Not Fail, The Inspiring Leadership of Winston Churchill. She's in town to speak this evening at 6 to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. That will take place at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. If you'd like more information, you can go to dfwworld.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and lecturer Celia Sands. She's also a granddaughter of Winston Churchill. She's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. That event takes place at 6 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. You can find information at dfwworld.org or on the Think page of KERA.org. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Celia, in addition to writing, another thing that you do is lead tours. Talk about where you go and what people come to see.
Well, this came out of a book I wrote about my grandfather's travels because I'd traveled with him in his later years. And so really, basically, I try to go to the places that he went to. I've been to taken tours to South Africa, to Morocco, to France, to Malta. This summer, I'm taking a boat. We're going on a boat, using it as a floating hotel in the south of France, because the south of France is a difficult place to go to without staying in another hotel every night. So what I try to do is, wherever we go, do the Churchill, all the Churchill places, wherever he went. I mean, this particular one in the south of France is following where he painted. And then essential tourism. For instance, if we go to South Africa, we must go and see the animals. If we went to India, we'd have to see the Taj Mahal, even if he never did. but they're not study tours. They're Churchillian holidays, I hope, which means we have good food, go to lovely places, stay in comfort, and have a good time.
Painting was a huge part of his life. And in fact, there are Churchill paintings in the collection of the Dallas Museum of Art. I don't know if you've had a chance to see them.
I was there at the opening. Mm-hmm. I came for the opening because Wendy Reeves, who donated them, was a great friend of mine. And I came, it was 1985, the exhibit was opened. And because, you know, I remember as a child going to her house in the south of France, which she recreated here in the museum, the room that my grandfather had. Mm-hmm. And so they're wonderful pictures. And she was an extraordinary woman. She was a Dallas girl. And she was a great character, always dressed in leopard skin clothes. She'd be very fashionable today because everything was animal print that she wore.
What did your grandfather, what was the value of taking time away from everything else to paint?
Well, I think in today's language, it was a stress buster. Mm-hmm. But he really loved it. He started in 1915, during the First World War, when he was at his lowest ebb. And he just picked up one of the children's paint boxes and started to paint. And that was watercolours. And then he decided he'd try oils, and he liked the oils much better. So, and he never looked back. I mean, wherever he went, except during World War II, he took his paints with him when he travelled. And took every opportunity to paint. And he absolutely loved it. He said, when I get to heaven, I want to spend the first million years painting and get to the bottom of the subject.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I read in an article a few years ago that he had a voice double. A lot of those speeches made during the war were done by an actor doing a remarkable impersonation. I was wondering if there's any validity to some of this stuff, and how do you get a gig like that? Thanks.
Are you an actor?
We've lost Ken, but I don't know if he's an actor or not. Is that true? I've never heard that story.
No, I honestly don't know the answer to that one because I've never found out the answer either, so I'm as wise to it as Ken is.
He was, everyone knows this, a hugely prolific writer. And writing, again, seems like something that would take so much time away from everything else. But was it a way for him of processing things he was thinking, or was it a way of distracting himself from what was going on day to day?
Absolutely neither of those. It was to make money. My mother said we used to live from pen to mouth. You know, we have the expression here, we live from hand to mouth.
Yeah.
Well, they lived from pen to mouth. Whenever he needed to make money, he would write an article or he would write a book. And he started by when he was in the army and he went first to India and then to the Sudan, he managed to get a contract with newspapers to send them articles back. And all the articles, he retained the rights so that he then turned them all into books. Mm-hmm. And so his books and his articles, they really were how he lived.
And he was not shy about wanting the very best of everything. Am I correct in that?
Oh, he liked the best, definitely. One day he was in the Plaza Hotel in New York, and the manager said, "Is everything to your satisfaction?" He said, "I'm a man of simple tastes, easily satisfied by the best."
Which gets expensive. And he was the highest paid writer of his generation for some time.
Well, certainly. And he was certainly the highest paid war correspondent during the Boer War. Mm-hmm. He went to South Africa and he was paid the most.
Talk about the trips that you've taken down there.
Well, South Africa is very close to my heart. I love it because I think it's where my grandfather had his most exciting adventures. And there, I don't know whether you've ever been to Africa, but no. Africa's a drug. And people who go once, they can't keep away. I mean, I lived in Africa for 5 years. But going there and picturing where my grandfather was and what he was doing, he was young. He was 25 when he was there. And he had the biggest adventures of his life. He went there having left the army, failed to get into Parliament, and he set off for the Boer War. Within 3 weeks of getting there, he'd been captured by the Boers and imprisoned. And a month later, he escaped from the prison and went on the run with a price of £25 on his head for his capture, dead or alive, which is really is more resonant of Texas than South Africa. And when he escaped from the prison, the minute he put his feet on the ground outside, they were on the international stage, and there he stayed for the rest of his life. People were following him because he had this American mother and a famous British father. Mm-hmm. The papers on both sides of the Atlantic were following his escape and his when he was running on the run, when they were looking for him, and of course when he got back. And he joined the army and continued to be a war correspondent for the next 9 months and had so many brushes with death, he should never have survived his first quarter century.
Is there truth to the story that because his father died young, I think at 45, that Churchill thought he himself might die young and ought to establish himself at a very early age?
Oh, very definitely. Absolutely, yes. So he wrote a letter to from the prison on his 25th birthday, and said, "I'm 25 today, so little time remains." Hmm. No, he was racing. He was what's called a young man in a hurry, racing along, had to achieve it and had to get it. And, of course, the strange thing is that when he really did make it, he was so very old compared to what how old people were in those days, as he was 65 when he became prime minister. And that was old at that time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. My guest this hour is Celia Sands, who's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll go back to the phones again. This time we will speak with Gus in Arlington. Hi, Gus.
Hi. My question has to do with there's several writings of World War II about when Winston Churchill came to America, and they said that he moved into the White House for a period of, I think, 1 to 2 months. What did he talk about in retrospect about that time?
I don't think he was there for that long. I haven't got the precise dates, but I know he came, and at one stage he said he must take himself away because he mustn't be there for too long, and he went to Florida. But he was when he was there, I think that the president loved having him, but I think Mrs. Roosevelt wasn't so keen. She thought he was a very bad influence on her husband, and they stayed up late, and they smoked, and they drank, and she wasn't at all pleased with the situation. But he came several times, and on one occasion he was opening a window, and maybe it was rather stiff, and he felt a pain in his chest, and he told his doctor, who was traveling with him, "I got a pain in my chest." And the doctor examined him and realized that he'd had a heart attack, but didn't tell him because he thought he mustn't tell anyone, not even my grandfather himself, that he'd had a heart attack, because he thought that would be very bad for the progress of the war. So he never knew until afterwards that that was the case. He was just, "Oh, you've pulled a muscle. Take it easy for a day or two."
And he just sort of kept going through that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about this. You have one memory of your grandfather ever watching television, and you were with him on that day.
I do. Well, I'm sure any of us who are old enough remember exactly where we were the day that President Kennedy died. I was with my grandfather, and we were in the house at Hyde Park Gate. And I'd never seen him watch television. The television was some sort of contraption that used to be in a side room for the children to watch. But it was put on the table, and we watched as the news unfolded before our eyes. And my grandfather was never shy of shedding a tear. So the tears poured down his face as, first of all, the news came in that the president had died. And then we watched Jackie Kennedy, who, observing the new president being sworn in on Air Force One, still wearing her bloodstained clothes. And, you know, they seemed, you know, to a lot of people, young and glamorous couple, but they seemed immeasurably glamorous and young to my grandfather, who was approaching his 90th year. Mm-hmm. And so this was something that, you know, moved him deeply. And certainly it was an extraordinary experience for me to have with him and to be there at that moment. It was very moving.
And he and President Kennedy had a sort of a special relationship.
Well, I don't think that they'd actually ever met, but President Kennedy had made him an honorary citizen of the United States, but he wasn't able to go and collect it himself. And it was President Kennedy who said that my grandfather mobilized the English language and sent it into battle.
Did the fact that your grandfather had an American mother have any influence on his fondness for the United States?
Oh, I'm sure it did, absolutely. And I think it had a huge influence on the sort of person that he was, because he was far less stuffy than the normal upper-class Englishman of the other people who were brought up in exactly the same way as him. But certainly he first came to America in 1895. He was on his way to see the first battle in Cuba. And he was looking for a war, and that was the only place there was a war going on. And he was coming for 2 days. And didn't think he was going to particularly like it terribly, but he came and he stayed for 10. And he was, I believe, people think that the special relationship started in the 40s with Roosevelt and Churchill, but I believe it started in 1895 when my grandfather came to New York and met Bert Cochran, who was a friend of his mother's. And he took him around and they became friends, and he became my grandfather's mentor, really. My grandfather said he was my model. He taught me how to hold thousands in thrall. He helped him with his speeches and all of that. And I think this was an extraordinary relationship.
What was the process by which Winston Churchill wrote his speeches? There are people who say he sort of wrote by committee, and you've said that's not entirely the case.
No, absolutely not. He had people who would research for him, but he wrote them. And, you know, I've spoken to the secretaries who were typing them, and he would walk up and down. They would have typewriters, which a lot of people won't know what a typewriter is now. And typewriters made a noise, terrible clattery noise, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. And they had to be muffled so that they didn't make a noise. And they would sit there taking dictation as he spoke. And he would walk up and down the room, and he would take an enormous amount of trouble over every speech, and he would want to roll the words around his tongue and all of that. Yes, no, he took a lot of trouble. But he always had notes, because one day he used to learn his speeches. And then one day he was in the House of Commons and he lost his thread. He said never again. He would always have his notes, even if he didn't need to use them.
Do you think he was a naturally gifted speaker, or was he that good because he worked on it?
He worked on it very, very hard, and I think then he no doubt became quite easy. But he worked on it very hard, and of course he did have this speech defect. And so that was certainly somewhat inhibiting. He was born with the difficulty pronouncing the letter S, and he went to many specialists. And finally he went to one and he said, I'm going into the army now, but I'm going into politics later. I can't spend my whole life avoiding the letter S. In fact, it sort of became his trademark, because when he was broadcasting to occupied Europe, people really knew it was him when he started speaking because of that.
What a huge obligation that must have been, not only to make the right decisions, but also to know that the emotions of the people that you are governing are very much tied to the way you express yourself.
Well, I think he was, his problem was to make everyone believe what he believed. And they had, so he had to believe in himself for them to believe in him. And I don't think he didn't always believe. I mean, he certainly had problems at the beginning believing that he could do it, because his job was not to win the war, but to stay in the war until he could persuade President Roosevelt, well, he didn't need much persuading, but could, till America would come into the war. He knew that Britain couldn't do it alone, and he knew that we needed America, but he had to sit it out, and it was quite a nerve-wracking business.
Why did it take him so long to get anyone to listen to his warnings about Adolf Hitler?
Well, the First World War was known as the war to end all wars. And, you know, in Britain, everyone was still smarting from it. There was a whole generation of single women around, mm-hmm. because all the men were killed. And they didn't want another war. And they didn't want to hear it. So they just put their hands over their ears and they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't. So therefore, people said he was a warmonger and that he wanted the war. Of course, he didn't want the war. He was trying to stop the war. But it was, no one wanted to hear what he was saying, and nor did they want to hear when he went to Fulton and made the Iron Curtain speech in 1946. It was exactly the same.
And that certainly hurt him politically when he made that speech, that people, again, didn't want to have their leaders presenting them with this sort of challenge.
In 1946?
Yeah.
Yes, no, absolutely. But it didn't take long for them to come around and realize that he was absolutely right.
My guest this hour is author and lecturer Celia Sands. She's the granddaughter of Winston Churchill and the author of multiple books, including We Shall Not Fail, The Inspiring Leadership of Winston Churchill. She will speak this evening at 6 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information about that at dfwworld.org, or you can go online to the Think page of kera.org. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and lecturer Celia Sands. You can learn more about her work and about what she calls her Churchillian holiday tours at celiasands.com. That's CELIASANDYS.com. She's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So you've done several different books. Have you done them? Have you approached them all the same way and sort of gone into a studio and sat down to write?
Not at all, no. I'm very undisciplined. My second book, I was planning, having written one book, which took my grandfather to the age of 20, mm-hmm. I then decided to carry on for the next 14 years till he got married. And I went to South Africa to promote my first book and found they had so few books there to promote that I was being interviewed on the television. And I said to the presenter, I think this is rather boring just to promote a book, which we haven't got any to sell anyway. So why don't we put out an appeal for anyone whose parent or grandparent had contact with Winston Churchill 100 years ago in the Boer War? And she was enchanted and put out this appeal. By the time I got back to my friend's house where I was staying, I had 60 replies.
Oh, my goodness.
So instead of writing a book about 14 years, I wrote a book about 9 months and had some of the best time of my life.
Well, it must be that people remember having met your grandfather.
Oh, they do. And in South Africa, he became sort of a legend in some mm-hmm. families, because so many people, he touched so many people in different ways. You know, He met the Brits, he met the Boers, he met the people who captured him, the people who imprisoned him, the people who helped him escape. I mean, there were endless different aspects to this story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the lines to Danny in Dallas. Hello, Danny.
Hi there. This is Danny. I'm calling from Dallas. I have a question to Mr. Church's granddaughter. Although Mr. Church did a great work during Second World War, but going to next door in Iran in 1953, he orchestrated a coup against Iranian Mossadegh. He overthrew the government, and the result of the overthrow of the legally and a democratically elected government became a regime of Shah, and the aftermath of the revolution became existing of government in Iran, which put the whole region on fire. So I'm sure she knows the history of his grandfather's work. I would like her to comment about the coup that Mr. Churchill orchestrated against Dr. Mossadegh in Iran, and the aftermath of it is today, and it's ongoing.
Well, Celia, you're shaking your head.
I'm afraid it doesn't come into my area of expertise. I don't know anything about that. I'm really sorry.
Right. We'll go on to the next call. This time we'll speak with Michael in Fort Worth. Hi, Michael.
Hi. What a thrill to listen to the insight on Winston Churchill. I was interested. It seemed like with what I've read and seen over the years that Winston and his wife, Clemmy, had a very, very special relationship, and I'm sure she helped support him with his black dog or the depression. I'd just love to hear a little bit more insight about that special relationship.
Thanks for your call.
Certainly. Well, my grandfather said that he got married and lived happily ever after. And I think that they did have a very good marriage. He was not an easy man to be married to. And I think that she was a great support to him. She was the only person who really, certainly after the war, probably could tell him what she thought. And he always listened. He didn't necessarily take her advice. But he needed a strong woman in his life. All through his life, there were three women. For the first 20 years, he had his nanny. For the next 14 years, he had his mother. And then he had his darling Clementine.
Talk about his relationship with his nanny. It was Mrs. Everest, is that right?
Yeah. Well, he said, "My nurse was my confidant. It was to her I poured out all my many troubles." And when she died, he said she was my best and closest friend for the first 20 years of my life. And she brought him up. His mother was beautiful, lovely, and in his words, she shone for me like the evening star. I loved her dearly, but at a distance. And that really summed it all up. So Mrs. Everest was the rock on which he built the first 20 years of his life. And I understand this completely because I was brought up by another Mrs. Everest type. And so I know perfectly well that she was the bosom that he cried on, the one who put him to bed, and the only person in the world who gave him unconditional love.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Robin who says, "I would love to know what, if any, games Mr. Churchill would play with his grandchildren."
Well, he liked building things. But I have to say that, you know, as I grew up, he was rather busy. But I think that he certainly, you know, with my brother and my cousin who were older, you know, he certainly played with their trains and things. And with his own children, he loved building tree houses and sandcastles on the beach. He liked sort of constructing.
Is it true that he would do bricklaying in his own yard?
Definitely, yes, he did that. And I think that was another stress buster. He laid quite a considerable amount of walls, a whole kitchen garden, a large garden, and some cottages. And the thing that he really liked doing with his grandchildren was going to visit his animals and feeding the animals. And so that was really the thing that we did. He loved anything, any living creatures, but he always had a poodle who'd come walking with us. He would have fish in the pond, and he would throw some food into the pond. The fish would come up, and he'd say, "Look, they know me."
He didn't ever actually have a bulldog?
He wanted a bulldog when he was at school, But I think he had one for a brief moment. But it's quite funny is that he did have a bulldog when he was a child. But.
And someone sent him one once as a gift that he passed on to you?
That's right, absolutely, yes. I got this parcel one day, which was a very sort of a large parcel wrapped in brown paper, very strange shape, with a note on it saying, "Please look after him, your loving grandpapa." And I feverishly undid it, and there was this bulldog. And it had wheels in his paws, and you pulled him along, and his head moved from side to side. He was magnificent. And I couldn't think why I'd got it. It wasn't my birthday. And my mother said, "Oh, it was given to Grandpapa, and he thought you'd like it." And so I said, "Why would anyone give it to him?" And she said, "Because he was known as the Great British Bulldog."
How have you passed all these stories on to your own children? Is it something that they've taken a particular interest in? Is it something that is it maybe mom's thing as opposed to their own?
Well, I have two generations of children. Mm-hmm. So my older two children didn't know my grandfather, but they knew my grandmother. Mm-hmm. So therefore, he was more immediate to them than. So there were events and occasions where he was part of it, although he was already dead. But my two younger ones, who came 20 years later, for them, he was history. Mm-hmm. But for them, but they've had another life because they've been living him with the work I've been doing, because they've been living through all the books. And so finally, at one stage, one of them said, "You know, Mummy, do you think we could have a non-Churchill holiday?" Because we'd be driving through France and suddenly I'd look at the map and say, "Oh, we must go there because we've got to go and visit that place." This is when I was doing my book on his travels. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly we'd divert where he'd painted a picture or something. But, you know, my youngest son, he's been doing exactly what my grandfather did at his age. He's went to Sandhurst, been in the army, been in Afghanistan, exactly where my grandfather was. History repeats itself 100 and something years later. Nothing's changed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Marion in Dallas. Hi, Marion.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Mrs. Sands, thank you so much for being here. My son is a junior at Westminster College.
Oh, how nice.
Yes.
Lovely, beautiful place. I've been there several times. It's lovely.
It absolutely is. And the Churchill Memorial is glorious, and as is the wonderful garden that's with the Berlin Wall.
Done by my sister.
I wondered if that was you or if that was your
sister. No, that's my sister.
That is a place of great peace. It also gives you a sense of perspective, which I think is so important at that age.
And the lovely Christopher Wren Church is so wonderful too, isn't it?
It's glorious. It is absolutely beautiful, and it's so fun to think of the kids actually having services in that church.
No, it's wonderful.
Yes, it truly is. So we thank you for everything that you've done.
Well, I hope that your son enjoys it very much.
He loves it, and he is very, very happy there.
Good.
And he's doing well, so we are thrilled.
Marion, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Denise in Dallas. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I have a question about Churchill's books. You had asked earlier if his speeches were written by committee. I'm wondering about his books because I love his History of the English-Speaking People. I inherited it from my father, and it's wonderful.
No, that was the book. No, his speeches were not written by committee. His books, obviously, he needed researchers, and he had researchers, but he wouldn't have allowed the written word or the spoken word to go out in someone else's voice. And so I think this was very important to him because he loved words. But, I mean, that was really the last book he wrote, practically. He finished that after he had to stop. He started before the war. He had to stop for the war. Then he wrote the war series, and then he finished the English-Speaking Peoples.
When you read the things that he wrote about his own life, are there places you feel like he was particularly careful about sort of not skirting around the truth, but leaving things out that were painful or difficult? Or do you feel like he was entirely candid about what he viewed his life to be?
Well, I think when he was writing personal things about his life, I think he probably wrote it how he saw it. Mm-hmm. But whether it was exactly as it was, you can't be sure. I mean, after all, he was looking back. He wrote My Early Life, when he was 34.
Still in his early life.
No, he was 50. Okay. He was 50 then. But he was looking back, remembering the first 34 years of his life. Mm-hmm. And he certainly wouldn't have wanted to write anything unhappy about his mother. Or, I mean, I think it was written, some of it was written with rose-tinted glasses.
Do you, to what extent at the end of his life was his failing health a source of frustration and sadness for him?
I think it was, he became what I describe as very tired, and eventually tired of life. Mm-hmm. Of course, he didn't, when you've lived that sort of life, it's probably better to go with a bang. Mm-hmm. But it took quite a long time. I mean, he had a long, one book was written by his private secretary called Long Sunset, and that rather perfectly described it. But it was peaceful, and you know, it was right up until 2 years before he died, he was still painting. But it certainly, you know, wasn't probably ideal, but he wasn't in any pain or in anything like that.
I'm curious what you think about this. In this country, at least, there are people on the left and people on the right, all of whom will say, we're with Churchill, and for this reason, you know, our values align with his. Would that have bothered him?
Sorry, I'm what?
Well, there are people sort of from both political parties that will call up aspects of things that
I think he'd like that. I think he certainly wasn't a party man. So he would like to feel that he appealed to all sorts of people. And I think that he crosses all boundaries. Even I went traveling in Japan once. I took an exhibition of his paintings and I asked the British ambassador, how is it that everyone's so welcoming? They're queuing around the block to see his paintings. After all, they should be hating him. He said, well, in 1945, they drew a line in the sand. So nothing got through that. And there was a big drama of the prisoners of war at that stage. And he said, the prisoners of war stay behind that line, but your grandfather got through the other side and they all think he's a great hero. There's a painting club called the Churchill Kai, which means club, in Tokyo. And where every year they have an exhibition of paintings which they've painted a la Churchill.
Are you still discovering things that you didn't know before?
Always, yes. The journey's never finished.
And talk about, you're working on now mostly the tours. Is that sort of your primary lecturing?
Well, I do probably two tours a year, and then I go and make speeches where anyone wants me to go and make a speech. And I enjoy that because I meet lovely people. I'm speaking in Texas this week and having a wonderful time visiting universities and the World Affairs Council. So I'm very pleased to be in Texas. Everyone's so welcoming.
Are the questions very different based on where you are?
I don't know. Not necessarily. Usually, people fundamentally, they want to know the same things.
My guest this hour has been Celia Sands. You can find her website at CeliaSands.com. She's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Celia, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed being with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.